Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're going to cover a couple of topics today on the show that affect us, I guess, more as we get older. First up, we're going to talk about movement disorders. And my guest, Dr. Kunal Gupta, is a neurologist is what I mean here, a neurologist, and he specializes in open and minimally invasive treatment of movement disorders, things like epilepsy, tremors, Parkinson's. Dr. Gupta works out of Frederick Hospital and the Medical College of Wisconsin. It's great to have him with us today. And as we talk with Dr. Gupta, I hope you'll join in. Do you or someone you care for have a movement disorder? What do you want to know about treatments? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@WPR.org. Dr. Gupta, welcome. Thank you for joining us today.
Hi, Larry. Thank you so much for having me.
I'm really intrigued by this minimal treatment that you have for some of the movement disorders. I think it's called MR guided focus ultrasound surgery. I was trying to run that through my head and I couldn't remember it all, but I think there it is. How long have you been working on this?
So thanks again for having me. My name is Kunal Gupta. I'm a neurosurgeon here at the Medical College of Wisconsin in Frederick. The MRI-guided focused ultrasound is a new treatment we have here in Milwaukee. It's a relatively new program for us. We started the program about a couple of months ago. We've been working on getting it here for the past couple of years, and the treatment itself has been around for about 6 to 8 years now.
So what is involved in it?
Yeah, so MRI-guided focused ultrasound is a new type of treatment for movement disorders, predominantly for essential tremor and Parkinson's disease. It's a procedure that's done by neurosurgeons such as myself. It involves coming in. The overall goal of the therapy is to create a small lesion measuring about 2 to 3 millimeters in a particular area of the brain called the thalamus. It's sort of fairly central in the brain. I consider it the switchboard for the brain. It sort of connects your brain to the rest of your body. If you make a little lesion in a strategic location, you can interrupt the tremor signals from getting out from the brain to the hand.
Wow. I'm thinking, so how does it work? What happens to an individual when you're doing this? I mean, I'm trying to think, do we have to shave the person's head? What goes on?
Yeah, so the procedure is done right here in Milwaukee. It's done at the Frederick Hospital. The folks come in on the day. We do have to shave the head completely. It's a complete shave down to the skin because the ultrasound has to conduct from a sort of a headset through the scalp and through the bone and into that area of the brain. Any little stubble has some hair, and the hair will block the ultrasound. So it's got to be a complete head shave. What I do is I put a little numbing medication into the scalp. We put on a frame, which is sort of a little headset that sort of holds the head in location. The person getting the focused ultrasound is then put into an actual MRI scanner. We hook you up to the bed. We add the ultrasound helmet. The ultrasound helmet is actually filled with water. So the water conducts the ultrasound from the transducing headset all the way down onto the surface, and then it all narrows down and sort of focuses down in that area of the thalamus, much like you might use a magnifying glass to focus sunlight onto a leaf to sort of burn it in a particular location. And then what we do, when everything's in place, I target that location and we slowly heat it up under MRI guidance. We test the tremor, and when we're in the right spot, we create that lesion. And that lesion sort of burns out that location. It's only 2 to 3 millimeters across. That's what stops the tremor.
And it stops it. Man. Forever?
So the procedure is relatively new. So it's been around for 6 to 8 years now. We have 5-year data that shows that it's robust and it sticks around for at least that long. There are a few, you know, all surgeries do have a failure rate, so you can have a few people have a recrudescence, but you can do other things or try again. But overall, the data are robust and reproducible out to 5 years so far, at least, if not longer.
Oh, my goodness. And again, remind me, what does this treatment, or who would benefit from this treatment? Let me put it that way. People with...
So at the moment, it's approved for essential tremor and Parkinson's disease. The people that benefit most for this really are folks with essential tremor. So that's a tremor that folks can have that gets worse when you move. People who are trying to write will find that their hand shakes when they write. When people are using a spoon to eat soup, you might scoop up the soup and the spoon starts shaking by the time you get to the mouth, spoon's empty.
Yeah.
Drinking a cup of coffee can be challenging. So folks with that sort of tremor would benefit a lot from this therapy. The way you treat it as well, you only treat one side at a time. So the brain and the body are back to front. So you treat the left brain to treat the right hand. So you treat one side at a time. So if someone has a favorite hand, a dominant hand, we typically go for that.
This has got to be life-changing.
The effects are remarkable.
How readily available is the treatment? I mean, you're doing it, but you can only see so many people in a day. I'm sure.
We're the only installation in Wisconsin. So it's a real privilege to be able to offer this to, wow, to our state and Wisconsinites. It really is a privilege.
I'm hoping that this is something that's going to be become very common. I'm thinking about how many people in the state of Wisconsin are affected by this. Do you know offhand? Yeah.
It is relatively common, essential tremor. In the general population, it's just under 1%, but it gets more common as you get older. So it's over 2-3% of people over 60, over 5% of people over 80. And these are large numbers. This is a lot of people.
Yeah. And so if you're undergoing this treatment, how often would you have to come in to visit the clinic and all that sort of thing?
Yeah. So folks with essential tremor are usually already meeting either a primary care doctor or a neurologist, and there are some medications that can be tried to help control the tremor. And for some folks, the medication does a great job, and that's fantastic. For some folks, the first medication may work initially and then gradually may become less effective over time. You may want to add a second medication. And once the medication stops working, that's when you end up meeting a neurosurgeon such as myself. And a focused ultrasound is a great option for folks that medication doesn't work for. So folks have often had it for a little while, and you've often met your doctor a few times to try and manage this before you end up meeting a neurosurgeon.
Yeah, I'm wondering about insurance.
Yeah, focused ultrasound is covered by insurance. Of course, the particular mileage with your insurance company can vary from person to person. But we do work with folk in their insurance to get coverage for this.
You've just been doing this a little while, but I got to believe that this would improve people's lives to no end, not only themselves, but their family and, loved ones.
Yeah, so the quality of life improvement is remarkable. Folks find that they can sign their own checks, write their own names. Eating is easier. A lot of folks who come and see me talk about being embarrassed to go to a restaurant and people sort of noticing their tremor. It definitely gives people some quality of life back.
It's amazing. And how do you? I mean, do you think this is going to be more readily available to people?
I think so. It's one of those things there. One of the old treatments or existing treatments is deep brain stimulation. Only this past year, the country as a whole has treated more people with focused ultrasound than DBS. So that's a remarkable inflection point for this therapy. DBS is still a very good therapy for certain folk, and there are some differences between the two, so deep brain stimulation. But I think more and more people, as we get, you know, more and more awareness about this, I think more and more people will come and seek this therapy.
What's happening to your body if you have a movement disorder? I mean, where does it come from?
Yeah, our best current understanding is that the control of movement is really complicated in the brain. So the surface of the brain sends signals out to the body, but it's all sort of regulated. There's a whole series of little relay loops inside the brain that help control the movement, so we don't overshoot, or we don't have tremor, or we don't undershoot. And we have reason to believe that it's those relay circuits that get disrupted. So they get overactive or underactive. And the goal with all the treatments is to put the regulation back into the relay loops. So whether it's putting some stimulation back in with deep brain stimulation in a particular location, or you take out a little group of cells that are overactive with the focus ultrasound. So that's what we think is going on in movement disorders and sort of how our interventions get involved to try and improve symptoms.
Are these essential, what are called essential tremors?
Essential tremors.
Essential
tremors. The essential kind of means that there's really nothing else causing them.
And would genetics play a role in this?
So we certainly do see folk with a family history of this. So, for example, people will say that my father had it, or my father's mom had it, my siblings have it. It's not absolutely required at all, but I certainly do hear it more often than you realize.
Mm. Dr. Kunal Gupta, our guest today, a neurosurgeon at Frederick Hospital and the Medical College of Wisconsin. His research is looking into new methods to treat epilepsy and advancing novel surgical techniques. It's great to have him with us. And I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234. You can email to talk at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. At noon today, we are going to talk about what you need to know before moving someone or maybe yourself into an assisted living facility, what's going on in that area. But right now, we're taking a look at treatments for movement disorders here in Wisconsin with our guest, Dr. Kunal Gupta, who specializes in treatment of these disorders. It's great to have these neurosurgeons. Great to have him with us today. And we'll take some calls now. Ron in Norwalk has been waiting a while, so let's go there. Ron, hello. Thank you for calling.
Yep, thank you. I've been diagnosed with restless leg syndrome, or RLS, and I'm not sure if this condition is something that's treatable with surgery. I'm just wondering if your guest is familiar with it, and I guess one of the options that I'm looking at, there's a device that goes around the below the knee, and it does an electrical kind of impulse. Anyway, it's supposedly been tested and approved for RLS. But I just like your guest comments on restless leg syndrome.
Yeah. So I'm sorry to hear about your condition. Restless legs, we certainly do see as part of the whole movement disorders practice. That's typically managed a little bit more by the neurologists with medications and devices that, as you suggested. I'm not aware of that as an indication for focus ultrasound just yet. There are some research going on into how DBS might help for restless legs, but that's I'd encourage you to meet with your primary care and your neurologist and sort of take a look at some of the sort of treatment options that are available to you, and maybe perhaps discuss that as a further option. If they feel that's an appropriate way to go, they can certainly have a conversation with their neurosurgeon that they work with and to see whether that's indicated. What we usually do is we will evaluate all any patients as a group. So we come to a combined sort of consensus opinion about each individual and how best to help them. At the moment, restless legs really isn't sort of something that we treat as a mainstay of with neurosurgical procedures, but that certainly is something where some research is happening right now.
Ron, thank you for calling. Sherry in Chippewa Falls will go to you now. Hi, Sherry.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My grandson and my granddaughter, who are both older, 16 and 18, have vocal cord dysfunction. And after my grandson ran a cross-country race, he collapsed and went into what I was described as a full-blown seizure. Totally out of it, arms and legs. My husband said he was flopping around like a fish. Doesn't remember anything about it, just remembers not being able to breathe. Is that common or?
Yeah, that sounds very scary. I'm sorry that happened. So seizures are, you know, a common manifestation of a number of different types of disorders, whether it's epilepsy or sort of a focal cord disorder. Really getting a really good handle on the diagnosis is probably a really important part of this. These things are typically managed by neurologists, and they can sort of start you on sort of the appropriate management for those sort of disorders. That's not something I typically encounter much during in neurosurgical practice. We do certainly treat epilepsy, and I do perform neurosurgery for epilepsy as well. So if seizures become a continued problem as part of an epilepsy disorder, that is something that eventually you may end up seeing a neurosurgeon for.
Yeah. Sherry, thank you for calling. Let's talk about epilepsy for a minute or two here. How does it differ from other movement disorders?
Yeah. So as a neurosurgeon, we would typically include epilepsy as sort of a different class of disorders, more of a seizure disorder than a movement disorder, even though they're both characterized by excessive movements at times. Epilepsy as a seizure disorder, there are lots and lots of different types of seizures, and the way that we classify them can get real complicated real fast. Sort of general way that we look at it is seizures that come from a particular part of the brain or seizures that come from sort of all over the brain all at once. The mainstay for these, again, is usually managed by either a primary care doctor or a neurologist, and typically with medications as well. So anti-seizure medications are kind of the mainstay. They can be very effective for some, but we know that for many patients, seizure medications don't always work, and you may have to add two or three seizure medications. And if the medications still don't work, you may well end up being evaluated for epilepsy surgery and seeing a surgeon that specializes in epilepsy surgery like myself.
Yeah. What would that surgery involve? I suppose there's no simple way to explain it, but can you?
Yeah, there are lots of different types of epilepsy surgery now, which is actually really nice because as close as 10, 20 years ago, we really didn't have too many options for epilepsy surgery. These are really proliferated now. So we have so many different options and we have lots of good data supporting these. Broadly, I put epilepsy surgery into a couple of categories. If you can find the area of the brain that's causing the seizures and it's relatively safe to remove or knock out, that's usually the biggest chance at creating a meaningful reduction of your seizure. And that might well be an open surgery to actually remove that part of the brain, or you can burn it out with a laser, and that's minimally invasive. The incisions for these are 1/4 inch in length. You put in a laser fiber and you can burn these out. So there's minimally invasive approaches for that as well. But if the area of the brain is too important or too broad, or you can't really safely take it out, there's different ways of sort of altering the function again with sort of like stimulating wires, and that can be either deep brain stimulation again. So we talked about it for movement disorders, but it's also approved for epilepsy. There's also another couple of stimulation types, responsive neurostimulation or RNS and vagus nerve stimulation. So these are sort of the mainstays for types of epilepsy that you can't remove and you're trying to sort of help just control the seizure network activity.
Cindy in Viroqua has a different kind of question. Let's go there. Hi, Cindy.
Hi. I just had a question. My husband's had Parkinson's, who was diagnosed about 12 years ago. He's been doing well with the medication, I should say, okay with it. At this point, we've noticed the medication isn't quite working as well. Because he's on a blood thinner, he cannot get the DBS. Is this ultrasound something that he would qualify for?
Yeah, so Parkinson's disease, where the medications are not controlling the symptoms as well, that's a good point at which to start thinking about sort of surgical options. The blood thinner does complicate things for an open surgery as well. Focused ultrasound is certainly an option, and it can be a good option for certain patients. The best way to do this is to have a chat with your neurologist and see what they think as well, and then they can refer you to sort of a surgeon as appropriate. Mm-hmm. And again, really these decisions are made as a team, which is actually really a wonderful way to approach this. You get a team, you get many minds on it, and you're really focused on one patient at a time. So,
Cindy, there you go. Thank you so much, and look into it then. It's certainly worth talking to you. And you recommend talking to his own doctor or their own doctor.
Yeah, that's the best place to start. Really talk about someone that you have a relationship with, and you can definitely bring up new ideas to them. And they can send referrals as appropriate if they need more specialist help. And we can create pathways that way, pathways and relationships, really support people.
Cindy, thank you for calling. Let's turn to Pat in Milwaukee. Pat, thank you for calling. Hello.
Aloha, Larry and Doctor. Just wanted to thank you very much, Doctor, for your research. I wish you had been around 25 years ago. Our dad, uncle, his brother, and three nephews all had Parkinson's. They're all gardeners, and they all are deceased, of course, for quite a number of years now. And all of them used Roundup. Do you find a connection or a link to the chemicals in Roundup?
So sorry to hear about the strong, there are so many folks in the family with Parkinson's disease. There have been a lot of studies now trying to connect various environmental influences on Parkinson's disease. I can't comment specifically on Roundup. There are some studies that have looked at pesticides, insecticides, other ones. There's a well-known chemical exposure that's happened different parts of the country that have been sort of linked with it. But just an association doesn't necessarily mean that they're caused by it. So it can be challenging to parse out these relationships. What we do know is that Parkinson's is going up over time. So it does seem to be getting more and more common. And that seems to be independent of our, ability as doctors and physicians to sort of diagnose this even better. So we think that the true rate is going up over time.
And where would you go to find information on those studies that you were mentioning?
So there are some really wonderful patient-facing groups that that can provide information on this. The Parkinson's Foundation, the Parkinson's Disease Association. There are a lot of local support groups as well that provide a lot of really good information, and they can help sort of synthesize some of the scientific literature into providing sort of a global opinion, because the scientific literature is mixed. You'll find data supporting going back and forth, and really it's the consensus. It's sort of understanding what it looks like in the big picture to sort of see where it's going. So I would encourage reaching out to these patient support groups first for some information, or your physician as well.
Pat, thank you for calling. Appreciate your call very much. Good to hear your voice. Miles in Middleton, it's your turn. Hi, Miles.
Hi, folks.
What's on your mind?
Well, I've got essential tremor, and it hasn't been officially diagnosed, but if I drew a circle, it would look like a jigsaw drew the circle, if I used the jigsaw. And I'm pretty sure I got it. My primary doctor agreed, but maybe a lower level. So my question is, at what level would a person have to be at to do the treatment that your guest described.
Hmm.
Any tests that person can
do. Right? Yeah, okay.
Yeah, absolutely. So sorry to hear about your central tremor. If your circles look like a jigsaw, that certainly is an indication that you have the essential tremor. Typically, folks will try a medication or two. A common one that folks start on is something called propranolol. That's a beta blocker, so some folks can't take it. Another one, a common one, is primidone, which is sort of a sedating medication. Basically, if you've tried a couple of medications and the tremor is still really bothering you and affecting your life, then that's a good time to start pursuing something like focus ultrasound.
And for that, again, going back to Miles's primary physician to maybe talk about it further and get a referral?
Yeah, that's a great place to start. Check with your primary care doctor, and then you can sort of talk about other referrals.
All right. Miles, thank you for calling. And Joyce in Madison, your turn. Hi, Joyce.
Hi. I would like you to address not just essential tremors, but intention tremors and resting tremors that are typical with Parkinson's. And then also, does the targeted ultrasound do anything to help tardive dyskinesias?
And maybe we could start by talking, what are intentional and what are resting tremors?
Let's talk about the different types of tremors. So we're talking about tremor of the hand or the arm, the shaking. The intention and rest and different words you may hear, action or kinetic or postural, these are all words that we use to describe when we see the tremor most. So if you see a resting tremor, it means that your hands are at rest by your side and you're distracted or doing something else, and you'll see it start to shake. The resting tremor is typically more characteristic of Parkinson's disease, sort of a resting tremor. Whereas an intention tremor, that tremor may well not be there at rest, but when you intend to do something, so say you're reaching out for a piece of paper, or reaching out with a pen, or reaching out with a spoon, an intention tremor, then the tremor gets worse with your intention. And that's really characteristic of essential tremor. There are other things like a kinetic tremor. Kinetic just means movement. So it's a tremor when you're moving. So that can overlap with the intention tremor, or action tremor. There's a tremor that's more common with action. So you might hear a lot of these terms all being used by your primary care or your neurologist, and they really just describe when we see the tremor most. While the tremor can be mixed, so you can have folks with Parkinson's disease who also have an action tremor component, really we're looking for sort of the constellation of what the different tremor types are and when we see them. So typically it's the action tremor or a postural tremor or an intention tremor that we're treating with essential tremor, and that's a good target for a focused ultrasound treatment.
Hmm. What's the difference between, let's say, tremors that are caused by anxiety or caffeine or medication as opposed to those that are caused by a neurological condition?
Yeah, so we do try to exclude sort of other reasons for the tremor. So that's why essential tremor is called essential, like essential hypertension, which is just it's not caused by anything else. But what you will find is that folks with essential tremor may well tell you that when I have a couple of cups of coffee, it gets worse. You certainly see, day-to-day actions have an effect on the tremor, drinking caffeine or avoiding it and things like that. But essential tremor is kind of there even when you haven't had had a couple of cups of coffee in the morning.
I'm just wondering, are there any risk factors or causes that increase a person's likelihood of developing essential tremors?
Right now, I'm not aware of any, really. One of the perhaps the more common ones is having folks in the family with it. Probably mm-hmm. makes it a little bit more common. That's not anything you can do to modify. Really, No, really, I guess. Not to my knowledge.
I was trying to get at, you know, are there lifestyle changes or things that somebody could do to help at least remove or reduce the movement disorders?
Yeah, so things like avoiding things that trigger your tremor. It can certainly be one of them.
So coffee, maybe.
Things like coffee, perhaps. There's, you know, medications we talked about. There are some assistive devices folks have tried. So, for example, it's harder to shake something that's heavy compared to something that's light. So people can get weighted silverware that's heavier to try and make it easier to eat. And that's really sort of a coping mechanism, a lifestyle modification that can help make, you know, day-to-day tasks mm-hmm. a little easier. There are some assistive technologies like that.
So the heavier forks and knives is basically?
Yeah, there are some. There's a whole group of sort of additive therapy groups that work alongside doctors. So occupational therapists, physical therapists. When you go to these movement support groups, they're often well supported by physical therapists and other sort of allied professionals. And they're experts at these sort of therapies that can help with day-to-day symptom improvements and sort of managing day-to-day symptoms. So local support groups are just fantastic for these sort of things as well.
Stephanie in Madison has something for us. Stephanie, hello. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. Good morning. So I have been listening to your segment this morning, and I wanted to share with you and your listeners that I am the director and founder of the Parkinson's Disease Alliance of Wisconsin, and our efforts are focused on establishing a Parkinson's disease registry in our state. And on October 1st, we introduced bipartisan legislation for the creation of the registry. And so I wanted to share that information to let your listeners know we're working toward that end to start collecting incidence and prevalence of Parkinson's in Wisconsin.
Stephanie, thanks a lot for calling. Dr. Gupta?
That's a terrific initiative. The more you know, the better. If you knew better, you know, if you had better statistics on the disease burden on this, in our state, we can do more to help our state and help Wisconsinites. That's a great initiative. Thank you.
Yeah, and Stephanie, just to add to it, are you contacting people? Are you having them contact you, or?
I would love for folks to contact me, and folks can also go to our website, which is PDAlliancewi.org, and there's a take action button on the website where folks can enter their name and address, and their elected officials will populate for their region. And there's a letter that people can either customize or just send as is to encourage their elected officials to support and co-sponsor the Parkinson's Disease Registry. So I'm happy to have folks contact me to learn more. Again, my website is pdalliancewi.org.
Stephanie, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Mike in Minocqua has a question for us. Let's go there. Hi, Mike.
Hey, Larry. Hey, Doug. I wanted to know about the age, if doctor had any ideas about age and Parkinson's. My dad had developed it when he was about 65. My brother developed it when he was more like 82 or so. And the other question is in that deep brain stimulation surgery, is it just as efficacious for movement as it is for tremor, or is it better suited for one or the other symptom?
So DBS is a very effective therapy. So deep brain stimulation, that's a surgery putting electrodes into the brain. It can be used for a lot of different things. Essential tremor, Parkinson's disease, can be used for epilepsy, can be used for dystonia. It's being researched for a whole host of other different neurological type disorders. It's very effective. It depends on a little bit on the individual, what we're trying to treat, and things like that. But in a well selected person, it can be extremely effective. In terms of the ages, Parkinson's relatively. It can vary from person to person what age people become symptomatic or develop the symptoms with Parkinson's disease. 50s to 60s can be relatively common. You can certainly see people develop it later in life as well. There's a certainly cohort of people that develop Parkinson's disease earlier. So I've certainly met people who've developed it in their 30s and 40s as well. Most common around the 50s and 60s range. So if you are interested in deep brain stimulation, you can discuss it with your primary care or neurologist. For all the folks interested in focused ultrasound and deep brain stimulation, we also evaluate folks of that as well. So speaking to us at Freighter through our central scheduling line is also certainly an appropriate way to go. And if you have a primary care or neurologist working with you already, we can certainly work with them to sort of create the care team around you.
Excellent. Mike, thank you again for calling. Nancy emailed. She's a 77-year-old female diagnosed with essential tremors when she was about 40. Now it affects both hands. Propranolol is slightly effective. She wonders what type of side effects the doctor is seeing after the surgery.
Yeah, so after focused ultrasound, there are some side effects that we would talk about if you come and met me, and we can talk about a little bit today. The area of the brain that we target is the way I sort of think about tremor is that you have to move and you have to feel where the movement is in your body. So it's sort of a movement sensation integration type problem. So if you think about it, then if you put a lesion in that location, you could potentially get some sensory side effects, a little bit of numbness to the fingertips or the lip are entirely possible. If you think about sort of movement as the sensory motor integration part again, so you can get a bit of balance can be affected a little bit. Typically these symptoms go away, but these are side effects that we talk about. Headache is entirely possible for pretty much any sort of neuro-based procedure.
Of course.
This is also also typically mild and also typically goes away. There are some side effects to talk about and to think about as well when considering these sort of procedures.
Dr. Kunal Gupta, our guest today, neurosurgeon. It's great to have him with us. He works on movement disorders and epilepsy at Frederick Hospital and the Medical College of Wisconsin. It's great to have him with us. Questions for him, give a call at 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining in today. Just a quick mention, tomorrow on the show, it's a Wildlife Wednesday. We talk with UW Wildlife Specialists David Drake and Jamie Knack, and Dan Small back as well to talk about this year's Wisconsin deer hunt. Right now, though, we're taking a look at movement disorders with Dr. Kunal Gupta, who specializes in open and minimally invasive treatment of movement disorders and epilepsy. And let's take another question here from an email. Amy wants some more information about other maybe less common movement disorders like PSP, progressive supranuclear palsy. How would someone find support or diagnostic help in smaller communities with fewer healthcare resources?
Yeah. So the rarer movement disorders, things like progressive supranuclear palsy or PSP, that's considered a Parkinson's plus disorder, Parkinson's plus syndrome. Really, the emphasis is on the plus. So it has some things that look like Parkinson's, but really it's a very different type of disorder that we don't really treat with surgery. Getting a diagnosis can be difficult. Finding the appropriate specialist can be difficult, especially in smaller communities. I think at that point, going through the community and services that you have, tapping into local support groups and seeking sort of specialist referrals to help in, even as sort of a a periodic check-in or just to create the care relationship can probably help you agree that that is, it can be difficult to get the subspecialty knowledge you need and slightly smaller communities, just because a lot of it seems to be centered around big cities and big facilities such as our own. But yeah, that's a very pertinent question.
Yeah. Frankie in Janesville, we'll go to you now. Hi, Frankie.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My husband's been recently diagnosed with CBD disease. I can't pronounce the correct name, but it's a rare neurodegenerative disease involving the brain. And apparently there's no cure or treatment, but his arms move. He doesn't even realize that he's moving his arms all around, even when he's sleeping. And I was wondering if you know or heard of any trials regarding this disease?
Yeah, I'm sorry to hear that. CBD, I'm sort of understanding, is corticobasal degeneration. That falls into the Parkinson's plus syndromes, emphasis on the plus part of it. These are sort of neurodegenerative disorders that look a little bit like Parkinson's, but really fall into a sort of a separate group. And again, these aren't things that are typically treated with surgery, such as DBS or focus ultrasound. So the best way to do this is to sort of speak to the physicians already taking care of you. And really these things tend to be, how can we best support you in making sort of, making daily life as good as it can be. So a lot of the emphasis is on the supportive care. Lean on support groups, family and your physician groups as well.
Frankie, thank you for calling. Teresa in Boston, we go to you. Hi, Teresa.
Awesome. Thank you. So I have a condition called familial spastic paraparesis, also known as hereditary spastic paraplegia, which basically causes spasticity and shaking in the legs and ultimate weakness, which will lead to wheelchair use. Currently only treated with baclofen to control the spasticity. I'm just curious if any of these treatments you're talking about today would be something worth investigating.
Okay, so spastic paraparesis, that's a sort of a spasticity disorder of the legs and lower extremities. So focus ultrasound DBS typically aren't sort of mainstays of treatment in those areas. For those disorders, you typically end up going through physiatry or rehabilitation medicine. There are links between those groups and neurosurgeons who can help with spasticity treatments. So baclofen you can take as a pill, but you can also take that. You can also have a surgical implant to put that a little bit closer to the spinal cord. So there are some neurosurgical interventions that sort of do go along with spasticity. It's not the ones we're talking about today, but that again also requires sort of a group of physicians to work together closely to give you the best care. So those options are available. I'm sure you have those options locally as well. We certainly do have these options at Freidert as well. Sorry to hear about your condition, but these are things that can be done.
Teresa, thank you very much for calling. And Tim in Middleton, I'll give you a chance. Hi, Tim.
Hi. I was wondering if the doctor could explain what the Parkinson's belt is that's in the Midwest that they say is part of higher incidence of Parkinson's disease, and also about some studies that have said golf courses might be a contributing factor, too.
Yeah, certainly. So we do know that the incidence of Parkinson's disease is going up over time. And we think that that's more than just physicians and doctors getting better at diagnosis Parkinson's disease. We do think that the true incidence is going up over the time. So that spurred a lot of research and people looking into things that might be responsible for these things. People have looked at pesticides, treatments, chemicals, environmental exposures. There are a lot of associations or correlations, which means that, you know, the two things may well go hand in hand, but they may not be causing each other. I'm not personally aware of any studies that have really demonstrated a strong causative link where something, an exposure to something, causes you to have Parkinson's later on. So more research in this space will hopefully help us find out more about it. Nothing I can really pinpoint right now.
And Nick in Green Bay, we'll go to you. Hi, Nick.
Hi. You kind of answered my question a little bit, but I'm on my sixth or seventh concussion, actually TBI, and the last one was pretty nasty. I was knocked up for 6 hours, and I was wondering, I watched a documentary for Ben Favre, and in the documentary he said that after so many concussions, that kind of increases your chances for Parkinson's. I was wondering if that was true. And like I said, you kind of answered the question on the last caller, but I was wondering if you could go into a little bit more detail on that.
Yeah, so traumatic brain injury, or TBI, has been linked with something called Parkinsonism. So we've talked a little bit with other callers about Parkinson's plus syndromes, emphasis on the plus, which is where things may look like Parkinson's, or they may sort of shake or have stiffness or other problems like that look like Parkinson's but aren't Parkinson's disease. So Parkinsonism is where folks will have potentially some of the symptoms that look like Parkinson's disease but aren't actually Parkinson's disease per se. There are some large studies that have associated with traumatic brain injury or CTE or chronic traumatic encephalopathy with Parkinsonism and Parkinson's disease, but kind of as a group and not really separated out Parkinson's disease and Parkinsonism. And I know this came up with Brett Favre's diagnosis as well. So I personally think that from my review of the literature looking into this, the link between traumatic brain injury and Parkinson's disease, I think that has yet to be established. Certainly you can see folks with symptoms of it as Parkinsonism, but I think that this hasn't been separated out in the research just yet.
Nick, thank you for calling. And John emailed from Oshkosh. His wife has a cervical dystonia with myoclonus. She receives Botox injections with moderate relief. Anything else otherwise?
Yeah, so cervical dystonia is definitely a movement disorder that can be treated with deep brain stimulation. I've certainly done this myself and offered this to my patients with good outcomes and results. So this is definitely something that you can pursue further. Again, movement disorders typically come in lots of different flavors, even within one diagnosis. So chatting with your neurologist and making sure that sort of they're comfortable with your diagnosis and the symptoms that you're trying to treat with either Botox or something as advanced as deep brain stimulation. Just make sure that everyone's on the same page with regards to sort of what we're expecting to treat, what sort of outcomes we're looking for, and that sort of thing. Cervical dystonia is something you can treat with deep brain stimulation.
And finally, if you're starting to see some tremor, should you go in and see your doctor?
Yes, getting a good diagnosis, I think, is important. At least even registering the problem that you're having and having them follow you, because oftentimes I'll meet people and a lot of people have a delay in the diagnosis. So the tremor may start. It's unclear exactly what it is. This happened to this has happened fairly commonly to my patients in the past. So just simply establishing the diagnosis can be helpful. This also happened to Katherine Hepburn, who had essential tremor. Yeah. She was originally diagnosed with Parkinson's disease and was later found out she had essential tremor. So these are very common stories. But if you start, at least start the conversation early, you can sort of start to get closer to a diagnosis that's accurate and some treatments that might be effective for you.
Dr. Gupta, it's been always a pleasure. Thank you so much. And I hope you'll come back and be with us again. I really appreciate your time.
Delighted. Thank you so much for having me.
Dr. Kunal Gupta, neurosurgeon at the Frederick Hospital and the Medical College of Wisconsin. Great to have him with us. Coming up, we're going to be taking a look at assisted living facilities. I'm Larry Mueller. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, going to spend the next hour looking at assisted living in Wisconsin. Our elderly population is increasing, and it means a higher demand for senior care services like nursing homes and assisted living. But how do we access these facilities? How do we pick the right one? And here to help us with that task is Jennifer Fisher. Jennifer's manager of the Aging and Disability Resource Center of Dane County. She works to connect Wisconsin residents with long-term care options. And as we talk to Jennifer, I hope you'll join in. What do you want to know about assisted living options in our state? What do they cost? Who staffs these facilities? Give a call. The number, 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Jennifer Fisher, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us. They really appreciate it.
Hi, thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Let's talk about to begin with, what's the difference between assisted living facilities and nursing homes? I'm thinking about the kind of care and so forth.
Yep. So yes, that is a big difference. So an assisted living facility is licensed by the state of Wisconsin, and so is a nursing home. But in an assisted living, there is a restriction on the number of hours of nursing care a resident can receive. So in an assisted living, a person cannot receive more than 3 hours of nursing care a week. Whereas in a nursing home, you know, the idea is potentially they could get 24-hour nursing care. So the availability of a registered nurse is very different.
Yeah, so there's somebody there all the time. And adult daycare centers, what services do they provide?
So an adult day center is something that provides more like activities, and they also provide meals. They can also help with personal cares. Say a person refuses to shower for you at home, they can often offer a shower. They can help toilet and dress, but that's for a really limited amount of time during the day. And it's also typically operates Monday through Friday. So maybe a place a person goes, but not every day. They don't live in an adult day center.
Yeah. And can people, I assume, can combine the use of an adult daycare center with assisted living, or can they not?
They could, but you might be double paying for some of the same services. So, you know, if you're in an assisted living, typically that facility will provide you with 3 meals a day. They will provide you with staff that can help with your personal cares, help transfer you. They can help. And they also do activities. So they will most often have an activity person who will do different building activities. Most of them will have those posted for people so they can pick and choose what they want to attend. Some assisted livings have their own transportation, so they may load people on a bus and take them someplace for an outing. You know, there are lots of different services that an assisted living can offer to people. And you know, assisted livings can also change over time. So right now, there's a lot of large communities that have been built that transition people through different levels of care. So people may start at an independent apartment, then move to maybe an apartment with some services. And then as their needs change, maybe move to a more assisted living because they need more services than an in-home coming into your own apartment could provide.
So what does, let's take adult daycare just to start with, what would that typically cost?
So the range would really depend on the adult day center, you know, anywhere from, depending on what they're doing for your person and how many hours you're there, maybe $100 to $150 a day. Some maybe a little cheaper depending. And so you will pay, you know, by the day or by the week. Some have a certain number of days you must come. So you might have to come at least 2 days a week or at least 3 days a week. Each of them are a little different, but you can often pick and choose. You don't have to come every day. And then some people choose to come every day.
Yeah. How many assisted living facilities are there in Wisconsin? Do we have any idea?
I'm sure the state of Wisconsin knows. but there are a lot. There are a lot. Yes, there are a lot. I don't have an exact number. I'm sorry.
Yeah, well, no, that's fine. There are a lot, and you occasionally read about problems with staffing of those facilities. That may be the bigger issue than the facility having a facility there around, but maybe there's not enough staff.
Yep, and that is really one question you should be asking when you go to a tour in assisted living. You should be asking what their staffing ratio is, and oftentimes the ratio is different during the day than at night. So you should also be asking, when you're touring in assisted living, you know, what is your staffing ratio during the day? What is your staffing ratio at night? Do you have a registered nurse on staff? If yes, how many hours do they provide support or that someone can consult with them on an issue? Because they vary across assisted livings. And so when you're making choices and comparing one facility to another, those are some of the questions you should be asking when you take a tour.
Is there some minimum that, say, an assisted living facility is required in terms of personnel, ratio of personnel to residents or people who are there?
There is not. That's why it varies. There hasn't been clear legislation that says you have to have X amount of staff per resident. You have to have enough staff to provide care. And sometimes then there may be a situation where a report is made to the Bureau of Assisted Living, who investigates reports on assisted living to say that there's not enough staffing to take care of people, or because of the staffing level, maybe some things have been missed, or medication has been missed, or responding to someone that needs help to get to the bathroom so that they don't soil themselves has been an issue. So the state of Wisconsin does post those violations. And so that's another thing people should look at when they're looking at facilities is, have they had violations and what have they been? How often have they had violations?
Yeah, can they be for-profit or non-profit? We have both.
Yep, they can be all the above.
And are there advantages to one over the other?
I don't necessarily know if there's advantages to one over the other. You know, what you're really looking for is a facility that meets your needs and your care level. And a facility can change over time as you're there. A strong manager of a facility can really make things run great. And maybe a newer manager who hasn't had as much experience or who has a lot of staffing issues can maybe struggle with things. So, you know, really touring a facility and getting the feel of it, Do the staff know the residents by name? Do they respond to them? Do the staff respond to them? Are there things going on? Do they have control over what time your meals are or what you eat? Or does everyone have to eat the same thing? You know, there are lots of choices in assisted living. So you really want to find the assisted living that meets your needs.
I was thinking about what you were talking about there, because I know of a person who had a relative in a very good assisted living facility, at least that's what they thought, with a really good staff. And then the place was purchased by another outfit. And then they brought in like a whole new staff, and my person did not like the new staff. The whole personality of the place changed, apparently.
Yep. And that can happen. That can really happen and change things. And then sometimes people can choose to move or need to have meetings to address issues that are happening. Everyone who lives in an assisted living has a care plan that talks about what services are given or offered to the person, and really spelling out what you need. You know, I may be a person who's used to showering in the morning, so I want a morning shower. I don't want someone who's going to say, you have to take a shower at 2 o'clock when we have time. You know, that's not going to fit my day. So really discussing those things also and writing those things out, like, this is my care plan. This is what's important to me. This is what I want.
Mark in Wisconsin Dells has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Larry. My question is, a comment first. I had two friends who put their spouses in assisted living or memory care. And those, about $10,000 a month. And then those people each died after 2 to 4 months. But I have an aunt that's been in one for several years. And my question is, how does a family avoid being liable for a huge bill like that, that would bankrupt an average person when the person in the home has run out of money?
Yeah.
Yep, that's a great question. So in Wisconsin, there is a program called Family Care, and that is across all of Wisconsin, and there's some different varieties that fall under family care. There's the traditional family care, there's partnership, and a self-directed program called IRIS. And that program helps to pay for long-term care for people in the community. So if you're in an assisted living and running out of money, people should contact their local Aging and Disability Resource Center. And there's ADRCs in every county in Wisconsin, and talk to them about their options. Because when someone spends down their private pay funds, and it's different if you're single or if you're married, because in Wisconsin, there are rules that allow spouses to keep a certain amount of assets. So it's called spousal impoverishment. Wisconsin wants to ensure that the spouse who's still living in the community doesn't impoverish themselves, so they're able to keep some assets. And the program will then help you fund your assisted living if that's the level of care that's determined that you need. But not every assisted living will accept that long-term care funding. So when people are looking at assisted living, they should also be asking those types of questions on if you accept long-term care. And if they do, another follow-up question that's also helpful is, how many beds do you accept it for? Because a facility may say they accept long-term care funding, but it may only be for a limited amount of beds. And so you also need to know that. Sometimes assisted livings will take long-term care funding, but will say, but you need to live here and pay privately for a period of time. Sometimes it's 1 year, sometimes 2 years, before you could go on a long-term care program.
Yeah, or sometimes it's 3 years.
Yep, it is. Yes.
Mark, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Medicaid would come into play here, would it not?
Yeah, yeah. So part of that long-term care program, a person needs to pass a functional screen that the ADRCs complete, and then they have to be eligible for Medicaid. So the ADRC would talk to you about Medicaid eligibility, what it is, how it works, how you apply, and then you apply through your local income maintenance consortium for that long-term care program, and we help you through that process. So an ADRC can help you know what types of information they'll be asking you for and help you walk through that process.
And you need, my guess is you need to be thinking about it. You can't wait till all the money runs out and then ask. You need to start, several months at least, I would assume, ahead of time.
Yes, yes. I like to say that your local Aging and Disability Resource Center is a place that you should call often. Because we are a great place for information. So when you're thinking about a move to assisted living, you know, ADRCs will talk to you about that and what things that you should consider when making a move. We often talk to people about money and how much things cost. So say I'm living in my own home or apartment and I'm considering a move for assisted living, we can talk to you about what kinds of services you're identifying that you need right now. Or are you looking to get more socialization, or have you stopped driving? And how much, if you would just buy those services in the community, would that cost you versus how much your assisted living would cost you? So, and really compare costs to see what it would cost you and how those things compare.
Our guest today, Jennifer Fisher, is manager of the Aging and Disability Resource Center of Dane County. She's been since it opened in 2012. She knows a whole lot, as you can are learning as you listen to her speak today. And if you have a question or comment or experience, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234. Or you could email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. We're taking a look at our assisted living options here in Wisconsin. Are you thinking about it, or do you have a loved one? I've had to go through that process a couple of years ago with my brother Mitch, and so I'm fairly well acquainted with what goes on in the process. But I tell you what, Jennifer Fisher knows a whole lot more than I know about it. So, and here she is ready to answer your questions or respond to comments that you might have about assisted living. The number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email the email address talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. I think you mentioned that memory care facilities are often associated with assisted living facilities.
Yes, there can be different levels of care, and one of those levels of care, like at a continuum is a memory care facility. But it's important to note that people can call themselves a memory care facility, and it doesn't necessarily mean that they have received more training or education. So when you're doing those tours of a facility and comparing, you should ask about the staff training. So if they're calling themselves a memory care facility, what extra training have staff received to work there? Have they had training on dementia and how to work with people who have Alzheimer's? Because that really is a specialized care need, and staff need extra training. And just because a facility is billed as a memory care facility doesn't necessarily mean that they've had that. So when you go to tour facilities, that's one of the questions you should be asking is what kind of specialized training do staff receive? And, you know, what is, you know, once again, the staffing ratio, because, you know, people who are in memory care often need more assistance because they have memory issues. And so what is that staffing ratio so that there are people on staff to help? You know, does your loved one need help with eating at mealtime? Do they need queuing to make sure that they eat? And does that facility have the staffing to be able to meet that need?
And I'm thinking about medications as well. If somebody with a memory issue, you need to have... No, go ahead.
Yeah, so oftentimes at a facility, yes, they will be administering the medications. So that's another question that you can ask about when you tour is, do they have a preferred pharmacy, or can you use any pharmacy that you want? Maybe I get my medications through the VA. Do I have to have them repackaged to come to the facility? Do they have to be packaged in a certain way? So those are all great questions to ask.
Cheryl in Iron Ridge has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And it's ironic you would be talking about this today because I've been through it with a number of friends and people. And I like what the lady said about checking to see what the prices would be to stay in your home with extra services. That's number one that I think is wonderful and people should do. And number two is, golly gee whiz, you know, if they just change the zoning, we could put up tiny homes on 10 acres somewhere and everybody would be happy.
Cheryl, thanks for calling. Jennifer, a comment?
Yeah, no, I think that that's important because people should make their choice of what they want with information. So, you know, that's why it is important to compare costs and what you need to do to stay in your home, if that's where you want to stay living, or maybe move. Because there are lots of things to think about when you're thinking about a move. And, you know, the cost to move, the cost to downsize. Maybe the move is moving from a two-story home to a one-story or a home to an apartment. You know, there's lots of things to consider and people should make choices that, you know, that they have education about so that they've researched and looked and compared. You know, that's why it's important. I'm going to say it again, to call ADRCs because we want to empower people with information and knowledge so that they can make decisions that meet their lifestyle.
Yeah, and there are so many possible ways that living at home may not work at all. You know, if there's really only Social Security income coming in, and you know, if you've got a house you're living in, maybe it's you got to sell the house.
Yeah, that's a possibility. Yes, it is. You know, I hate to say it, but our prices for everything is going up. Your groceries, your electric, prices are changing. And so, yeah, ADRCs are equipped to talk to people about money issues and how things cost, how much they're costing. We also, when people call us, do like a benefit snapshot to see if there are programs that people could take advantage of. You know, if someone's living in their own home, maybe they can take advantage of a program here to save money, to apply money somewhere else, to help meet their daily needs.
Steve in Beloit, we'll go to you now. Hi, Steve.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Absolutely. What's on your mind?
My wife and I have a house with a mother-in-law suite, and we specifically bought it for when my dad can't quite take care of himself anymore. He can come and live with us and still have his space. My question for your guest is, it would kind of be quasi-assisted living, but my wife is also an RN to provide medical support. Is there something available for us or my wife as a caretaker for my dad for what we do?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So there's programs out there. The Older American Act funds programs called the National Family Caregiver Support Program. So that families can apply for through their local aging unit. Oftentimes, aging units are located in an ADRC, or they may be a freestanding unit per county. And they have funding like the National Family Caregiver Support Program that can help support caregivers who are providing care. Also, if someone has Alzheimer's, there's the Alzheimer's Family Caregiver Support Program that can help provide support. There's also support through the Respite Care Center of Wisconsin. There's lots of different programs. And your local Aging and Disability Resource Center can tell you about programs in your area and how people qualify for them, because there are limited amounts of funding. So there may be a wait for a program, but you can talk to them. Also, the family care program that can pay for an assisted living can also pay for services and supports in a person's home, or if someone is living with someone else, to help support that person and help them to remain living in the community. And it can pay caregivers.
Yeah, so lots of options there, Steve. And by the way, I'm glad you're mentioning the Aging and Disability Resource Center. Very often people come and go as they're listening to the show, and they may not remember, but that ADRC, American Aging and Disability Resource Center, should be sticking in everybody's mind here by the time the show's over, and that's good information to have in your noggin.
Yes, yes. Because, you know, we're the, we want to be the first place that you call for information. And we provide unbiased information on a wide range of topics, like assisted living or staying in your home. And we are here just to provide information so that people can make choices that meet their lifestyle and what they're looking for.
Steve, thanks again for calling. Dwayne in Westfield, we'll go to you. Dwayne, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, thank you. Longtime listener. Love your show.
Thank you.
You're welcome. As a matter of fact, I've lived it firsthand when my mom had cancer. Now, she had dual citizenship. Now, in England, they do things a bit different than they do here, which I don't understand why we don't try to adopt what they do over there. Because if you have if you try to keep home with hospice care or anything else, the U.S. usually takes more than half or all of their funds. And if they try to have home care, their funds only last they only do the health care at home as long as the money runs, is still in their accounts. Once it is different, once it's not, they go into a different, they're pretty much on their own. They pretty much have nothing. But in England, everything is 100% up until the time that just to try to make them comfortable, they can stay home, they have their own hospice care, and the government doesn't touch a dime of their finances, so they can, if they need other medical things, they can take care of it for themselves. If not, then at least they're a little bit more comfortable of trying to be at home. I'm just curious, why can't we adopt a program, the stuff like that over in England, that's a little bit more sensible?
Well, Jennifer, that may be a hard question for you to answer. I don't know. What do you think?
I think that is a hard one for me to answer. I can talk about what the programs look like now. The funding for the long-term care programs has come out of the Medicaid budget. So that's and Medicaid eligibility, because the money comes out of Medicaid is one of those requirements. And I think, looking at changing those programs would need some work to be done.
At the political level, yeah.
Yes.
Tim emailed, he would prefer we reference assisted living facilities as assisted living communities. He thinks facilities make them sound prison-like. Well, go ahead, Jennifer.
Yes. And some are freestanding buildings. Some are part of communities that are much larger. Another term that people often use also for assisted living is the community-based residential facility. It's called a CBRF. So that's also another word that's interchangeable with assisted living.
Mark emailed, does ADRC fund the MindWorks group? I think that might be a memory care facility in the Fox Valley. You may not know.
I'm sorry. I don't know that one.
Is that typical that ADRC would fund a another group or organization perhaps like that, a memory care?
Not typical, maybe through an NFCSP or AFCSP program that they're providing for a specific person. But we typically don't pay for assisted living. ADRCs do the enrollment into long-term care. And then once a person enrolls, we transfer them to the program that they choose. And then that program would fund services and develop a person's service plan.
Frank in Springbrook has a question for us. Let's go, or a comment. Let's go there. Hi, Frank.
Yeah, hi. I saw a documentary years ago, and it was from Denmark, and it's how they approach housing, especially for the elderly. And they have these housing units where they have very old people, elderly people. They have married people with children, maybe some single people. And they live in these apartment complexes, and they each have their own apartment, but they also live collectively. They have meals together, things like that. Do we have any equivalent to that here in Wisconsin or in the United States? Are anybody trying that kind of approach to addressing housing for elderly people?
So multi-generational housing, so I guess you might say.
Yeah. So I can talk about in Dane County. you know, I am familiar with at least one, maybe two of those types of facilities here in Dane County that have multi-generational housing together. Some of them are, you know, where people own the house, some where people, you know, the an organization owns them and people go there to live. They're a little different. But that is a, yes, there are some of those. It's not, there's not a ton, but there are some.
Hmm. Frank, thank you. Michelle in Janesville. Hi.
Hello.
What can we do for you?
I have a question regarding assisted living for my handicapped sister. She is severely intellectually handicapped, and we've been having difficulties trying to find a place that will accept her because she requires too much care. We can't even find any day services that will accept her, and my elderly mom is currently taking care of her and is struggling. So I don't know, like, where to turn to from here. I know there has been talk about, you know, possibly then they're going to have to sedate her or move her out of state. Or so I'm just looking for some information on, like, where, who do I ask, where do I turn to from here?
In Janesville, you do have an Aging and Disability Resource Center. There are also some regulations for people with intellectual disabilities and the and assisted livings. There's some bed limits on the size of facilities that they can move into for an assisted living. And then also, you know, like I said, an assisted living has a limited number of hours of nursing care that they by license can provide. So it may be, I don't know the care that your sister needs, but it may be that some of those things are in are into account, because ultimately when you do tour an assisted living, it's a two-way street on, you need to decide you want to live there, and the facility also needs to decide if they are able to meet your care needs. So just because you tour a facility and feel like that's a good facility for you doesn't necessarily mean that they will admit you, because they also have to, yes, make sure that they can meet your care needs. But I would encourage you to call your local ADRC in Janesville, because they can also talk to you about what needs the facilities can provide, and get more information about your specific situation with your sister.
So to find to find this proper location for Michelle or anybody else who's looking for their ADRC, what's the best approach? Can you go online and say ADRC Wisconsin and then type your county in or something and get the information?
Yep. And you can also type in findmyadrc.org. Wisconsin has that. Yes. And if you call 1-ADRC and they see that you live somewhere else, we can all transfer you to your local Aging and Disability Resource Center. Although we're based around the state, we will help people get to where they need to get to.
Let's take another call or a comment here. Lauren from Trempealeau County. Rural areas are lucky to have one facility, and they're filled with long waiting lists. She wants to know what's being done to close this gap in rural Wisconsin. Are there, you know, anything going on in the way of trying to get some legislation, or what's going on there that you know of?
I don't know. I'm sorry. I can't answer that. But I do know that, yes, there are limited facilities. Same even with nursing homes, that there's limited nursing home availability. And sometimes people end up having to live not in the community where they want to live because they need to go to where there is a facility that has openings.
Another question about the type of food. What type of food should residents in assisted living expect?
I think you should expect your healthy diet. And then, you know, some people need to follow a specific diet because of I'm a diabetic or I have heart disease. And so asking if they can meet those dietary restrictions, or maybe I'm a vegetarian, and do you have the staff available to make those meals? You know, also sometimes facilities have a kitchen on staff, and sometimes a facility, you know, might bring food in. So when you're touring and looking, you're also making your needs or what you're looking for known to them and asking them if they can meet those needs.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking back to my brother when we first, he loved the food at the facility that he was at. And when I would come to visit him, he passed away this last February, but when I would come to visit him, there, I would look on the, they had a chalk, kind of a whiteboard instead of a chalkboard, a whiteboard that always listed what the meals of the day were. And I'd always take a look at those. And they were always balanced meals. And they had a kitchen on, you know, there was a kitchen there with somebody to do the cooking on site. So it was a great, made me feel better.
Yes. And, you know, people still, you know, even in an assisted living, they still have choices and have great meals. They can, you know, have great activities. You know, social isolation and loneliness is also an issue for people. And in a facility, you're living, you know, with oftentimes many other people in an assisted living. It can be anywhere from 8 beds, six and over is considered a community-based residential facility, to, you know, 100 or hundreds, depending. So it's also, you know, a place where people can have great activities and things to do and the ability to see other people, where you know, sometimes people choose to move because they're isolated and they're lonely and they don't drive anymore. And this is a way to have more interaction and have activities.
Harry in Madison, we'll go to you next. Hi, Harry.
Hi there. I'm a certified financial planner, and I had a client in my office this morning, and we were talking exactly about this topic. But do you have recommendations? Because the clients that I'm referring to are, they're healthy. They can, you know, they don't need assisted living right now. They're completely independent. And is there facilities that have, you know, different tiers within their complex that say, okay, if you're totally fine, self-contained, you're over here. And then if you need help with meals, or if you need help, like, is there separate, you know, opportunities for people within the same facility, or
and
what's your recommendation there?
And your clients are in Dane County.
Yep. And so that's where one of those, you know, more assisted living communities are fit that kind of question and situation, because oftentimes they'll have apartments that people can move into that they live independently in the apartment. And then they may have a next level where they're living independently in an apartment, but they can get so many services a day. So maybe people can still be in their own apartment, but they want some help with their medication, or they want help with laundry and cleaning, so they can kind of get some a la carte services depending on their needs. And then as things with people progress, you know, those levels of care progress. So maybe then my next step is I'm moving from an apartment with services to an assisted living where they're making me three meals a day and they're doing my medications, and I'm in a smaller room instead of an apartment, or and then, you know, they're helping me with dressing or bathing. So yes, there are those like continuum of care places. Those are actually, you know, especially in the Dane County area, getting more popular, and facilities are expanding to increase other levels. You know, some even have condos that they start out with. So there's lots of different options.
How would Harry or his clients find those facilities? I mean, is there a specific kind of name for them, or what?
They're like continuing care communities. You know, they could call the ADRC and we can give them a list of what's available, like what those facilities are and how to contact them and to talk to them. Some places have you do what they call like a life lease. So you have to pay so much money initially to get into that continuum of care. But then you might get a portion of that back later on. Yeah, there's lots of different options for people out there.
You know, I got so enthralled with the conversation, I forgot to take a break, and we'll do that. Let's do it right now. And Jennifer, in our last, we've got another minute or so, minute and a half to go. What's your advice? I think I can already almost spit it out myself, but you guys, ADRCs, I keep getting the letters mixed around, the ADRCs are there to help, and people, no matter where you live in Wisconsin, right?
Yes, yeah. And we're here to give you information. We're not here to make decisions for you. We want to give you information so that you can take that information and make decisions on what fits your lifestyle and what you are looking for. And so that's why we're an unbiased place for information. So we want people to call us and to get that information and then make great decisions that fit their lifestyle.
Well, you're doing wonderful work, I can tell you that. And as are the ADRCs around the state of Wisconsin, thanks for representing all of them today. Jennifer, you were great, and I hope we can do this again. There's certainly questions I didn't get to yet today on the show. Thank you.
Yes, definitely. Thank you.
Jennifer Fisher is manager of the Aging and Disability Resource Center of Dane County and has been in that since it opened in 2012. She does a great job. And thank you very much, Jennifer. And thank you for listening today. Big team effort. Clara Neipert and Joel Patnaw, Jeff Robbins, Lee Rayburn with us as part of our team. And, of course, our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. And thank you again for listening, and stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.